It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. PFAS chemicals have been a growing concern in Wisconsin, with high levels found in groundwater and drinking water in many communities.
New research is tackling another question: are these forever chemicals showing up in people? A new study looked at the levels of PFAS in the blood of over 600 adults in Wisconsin.
These substances have been linked to cancer, changes in metabolism, and lower birth weight, among other complications.
The researchers were unable to make a direct cause and effect relationships, but the study did find out who is more likely to have higher PFAS levels, and that two foods in particular are linked to higher levels of the chemicals in a person's blood.
Amy Schultz is a researcher and co-author for that study, recently published in the Journal of Environmental Research. She's an epidemiology senior data scientist with the Real World Evidence to Advance Community Health, or REACH, program at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, happy to be here.
First of all, can you talk about the importance of trying to figure out, okay, is this PFAS that we know is in water in many places in Wisconsin is ending up in us?
Yeah, well, it's important for us to understand a baseline of prevalence of PFAS exposure. You know, how many people have detectable levels? What's the dose of exposure? How high are those levels? It enables us to continue to do research. You know, it lets us know, are there subpopulations that may be more exposed that we previously were unaware of outside of known contamination sites or areas of concern? And then it allows us to compare prevalence of PFAS exposure in a general Wisconsin adult sample to a national population. You know, are Wisconsinites more or less exposed to PFAS?
We're going to look at those results and see, you know, who seemed to have more PFAS in their blood, what things might be linked at it. Before we do that, I want to put a little asterisk on it, Amy. If I'm reading your research right, we're not seeing something where people should be alarmed about it, where if they say, oh, I eat that or I'm in that category, I should be really worried. Do I have that about right?
That's correct. This is an initial preliminary study that we use existing data. Mm-hmm. So it was an existing cohort of Wisconsin adults. They'd already provided survey data and interview data on behaviors, dietary information, demographics, and stored serum samples, blood samples, for research such as this one. But because the data we use was not specifically asked in such a way to get at all potential sources of PFAS, mm-hmm. there's, you know, potential associations we weren't able to uncover, and more research is needed to really understand the associations we did find.
Okay.
It's also important to note that this was just one point in time that we looked at PFAS exposure in. Exposures change over the course of time, depending on, you know, what products and occupations people have, for instance.
With those disclaimers out of the way, what kind of things stood out to you when you compared PFAS levels in the blood of people from, as you said, different demographic groups, people who lived and ate differently?
Yeah, so in our study sample, we looked at microwave popcorn consumption frequency, dental floss use, eating locally caught fish from inland water bodies, Great Lakes area, meat consumption, vegetable intake. We also looked at whether you get drinking water from a private well versus a municipality, fast food consumption. So we looked at a variety of factors that we had information on, and we wanted to see within our study sample, how did those that have higher levels of PFAS compared to those that had lower levels. And what we found was older age males, non-Hispanic white adults, those from higher household income, and those who eat locally caught fish were more likely to have higher serum PFAS within our study sample.
So let's look at the locally caught fish. Fish are in water. Makes sense. That's where we find a lot of PFAS. When we worry about things like mercury contamination, we might end up saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't be eating these fish. Again, if I'm reading your report right, we're not there at this point. There's some higher blood level of PFAS in people eating that locally caught fish. I'm not alarmed about eating that walleye at this point?
No, you should not be alarmed for several reasons. One is the information we had on eating locally caught fish wasn't very detailed. So we weren't able to look at how many locally caught fish you eat per year and if that's related to increased dose of PFAS exposure. We didn't look at type of fish or specific water bodies or waterways. Also, I should note that, as I said earlier, it's very possible those in our study sample that eat locally caught fish are also more likely to be exposed to PFAS via another source that we weren't able to look at. For example, they may be more likely to also eat store-bought, commercially bought fish, and maybe they're getting PFAS from that source, and that's explaining the association we're seeing. I'm not saying that's true, but we just don't know. So we would need to do a follow-up study to really understand the underlying factors with these associations. Another important point is the difference in overall PFAS we found among those who eat locally caught fish and those who don't may not be clinically meaningful, meaning having a PFOS level of 5.6 parts per billion on average compared to 4.2 might not mean that you have any increased risk of an adverse health effect. So that requires additional research as well. We just don't know at this time.
Talking to Amy Schultz, epidemiologist with UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at one study that tried to get at the question, is PFAS in Wisconsin water ending up in Wisconsin people? And Amy, a lot of what we're saying here points toward the challenges of studying PFAS in our bloodstreams. This is kind of an opportunistic study. This is blood that had been sampled for something else. You went back and looked at it. With what you have in hand now, what would you want to see? What would be your ideal design for more studies that could drill deeper into these questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are several ideal next steps. One would be to dive into the trends seen in this study by gathering more specific and detailed sources of exposure information. So actually measuring PFAS in drinking water from these participants, more detailed dietary items, occupational exposure, consumer products. We didn't ask about nonstick cookware use or anything like that. Also, you know, some of these associations, there's clear underlying factors. So higher household income itself does not give you PFAS, right? So what are the underlying factors or behaviors among those in our study sample with higher incomes that might be driving that? Also, this is a first look and provides a baseline. So now we can track changes in PFAS in the population over time. So in the next 5, 10, 15 years, do we see decreases in PFAS among our study sample, in specifically after EPA has passed, the Environmental Protection Agency in 2024, has ruled to regulate PFAS in several ways, such as drinking water standards and manufacturing and cleanup sites. So that's another area. And then expanding the research to include more adults, so a larger study sample, more adults from diverse racial and ethnic communities in Wisconsin, and also to more geographical regions in the state. This was demographically representative largely, but there are geographical representation that could be expanded.
And that I wanted to mention geography. We know there are many places in Wisconsin downstream, their groundwater is downstream in effect from sources, airports, manufacturing facilities that put a lot of PFAS into the environment. Would you see use in more intensive study, more sample collection from people who live in areas where we know there's a lot of PFAS in the water?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of utility in ensuring levels are going down as those sites are cleaned up, as they become regulated under the new EPA Superfund is now has two of the PFOS on the list to be under the cleanup site. So I think there will be need for sampling in areas of known high exposure. The utility of doing a general sampling of PFOS prevalence among Wisconsin adults is also just to potentially understand if there are other subpopulations that stand out as being having a higher exposure. We didn't see that, but we wanted to look, right? Because it's not just geography that's associated with PFAS exposure. It could be certain subpopulations or demographics that are exposed at higher levels because of different behaviors, maybe cultural ones or consumer behaviors are different among different populations. And so we wanted to look at that as well.
Another challenge that pops in my head, and you've pointed toward this, I sometimes think PFAS is a thing. You've mentioned multiple times. There's hundreds of kinds of chemicals in these classes. Does that make it hard to test for all these different types of chemicals? Do we have tests that can test for lots of things, or are we doing them kind of one at a time?
That's a great question. PFAS exposure and the health effects associated with PFAS exposure are very difficult to specify for many reasons. There are actually at least 5,000 PFAS compounds, and they have varying toxicity levels, potentially varying health effects. And you're right in that most studies to date have focused on a limited number of better-known PFAS compounds. And that's largely because it's very expensive to test and to develop assays and tests to actually measure these in different analytes. So, I mean, like different mediums, so in blood versus in a food product or household dust or in water. So it's quite costly, and to get a large enough human study sample to donate blood, for instance, is also quite costly. There are potential findings from this study that are informative, in that one thing I haven't mentioned is that while over 96% of Wisconsin adults in our study sample had detectable levels for 6 PFAS compounds. For 8 of the PFAS compounds, no one in the study sample had detectable levels. And for an additional 9 PFAS compounds we looked at, fewer than 10 people had detectable levels. So there are PFAS compounds that either the half-life is short and they're not remaining in the body for very long, or exposure is very limited or very sparse, and it's not in a lot of consumer products.
And Amy, we'll leave it there. That's Amy Schultz, Epidemiology Senior Data Scientist with the Real World Evidence to Advance Community Health, or REACH program, at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about efforts to track PFAS in our bloodstreams.
Coming up, federal cuts to food inspection programs. On top of already tight staffing, have food safety experts worried. A Wisconsinite with decades of experience shares her concerns.
We've had the Boar's Head outbreak. I do not want to see that again. It should not take deaths for us to react to something like that.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that inadequate sanitation practices led to last year's listeria outbreak that left 10 people dead and dozens hospitalized.
Outbreaks of foodborne illness and product recalls can impact how safe people feel the food supply is.
And that confidence is at an all-time low, according to a new survey from the International Food Information Council.
In just a bit, we'll talk about what goes into the U.S. food safety system.
But first, low staffing levels at the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, or FSIS, have made the job more difficult and could have an impact on food safety and public health.
Paula Soldner is chair of the National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals. For more than 30 years, she worked as a food safety inspector in southern Wisconsin. I talked to her when she was in Beloit. Paula, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me today.
Well, you've been a food inspector for the USDA for a long time now. You work with others around the country. Can you give us a basic sense of what the job is? What goes into being a food safety inspector?
Well, there's a lot, Rob, that goes into it, and it starts where the slaughter operations go, whether it is a pig, a cow, a lamb, a buffalo, whatever the case may be. There is inspectors that are inspecting those animals to make sure that there is no diseases, and if they do find some abnormalities, they're able to rail it out to have the public health veterinarian make a final determination on it. That's the slaughter floor. In various processing facilities throughout the entire country, you know, they are inspecting sanitation, whether there is rodents that are going around in the plant, or just making a general safe working environment in all those processing facilities. And those processing facilities can range from a bratwurst made in Wisconsin to pizza made in Texas, or briskets, whatever the case may be. So the inspectors do have a great critical full-time position in all of the federally inspected establishments throughout the entire country.
And then when that food inspector is in on the job, what does that authority look like if they see rodents, God forbid, or whatever the problem is? Do they file a report? Can they shut things down? What is the next step when you see those potentially serious violations?
When there is a serious violation, the inspector should take a regulatory control action. And that could be, you know, either shutting down the plant with cooperation of their supervisors in the chain of command of what needs to happen, depending on what they actually observe. If it's imminent, yeah, there's going to be some action that's taken, but there's also going to be communication between the inspector and their supervisor, and probably the supervisors up above them, of what needs to go there. So that is a very critical piece of inspectors doing their job.
When I think about all the facilities that'll do the various things you talk about, from slaughterhouses to processing and so on, I think there's probably a lot of them, and some of them are pretty big. I've heard that staffing was already stretched pretty thin, even, you know, last year, 2024. What were you seeing when it came to workload before we entered this new year and this new administration?
Well, staffing has been a critical hard time for FSIS to recruit and retain inspectors. And that goes back for 10, 15 years. The union, in collaboration with the agency, we would go out for events to help retain, and meaning going to community college, technical colleges, a college where there was veterinary science or any type of food safety science programs. So it was short staffed for many years. And now it is even getting to be a more critical, because people don't want to come and work for the federal government, knowing the environment that we are working in right now.
On top of that, the USDA recently notified union leaders of the Food Safety Inspection Service that it's planning to end contracts for thousands of employees, effectively ending that union representation, as I understand it, that you were talking about. What do you see the impact being there?
The impact is huge for an inspector trying to go out there and do their job. When an inspector goes out there, they need to be doing their job. And I am 100% confident they all will. But in cases where they may find a unsafe product, improperly labeled product, the inspectors are getting very reluctant to raise their hand to contact their supervisors, because there is no protection. No protection for that inspector to raise a problem up the chain of command. As we know it now, the FSIS administrator, Dr. Ramsey, is a previous Tyson employee. Now, I've never met the guy. I'm not going to prejudge him. But when you are a company employee and then go into a regulatory agency, you're going to side with that company. And that is the fear of not having that contract protection in there for inspectors to do their job the way that they have been hired to do.
Do you have concerns that the loss of these union protections will lead people to leave the field, leave the job, and maybe make those staffing shortfalls even shorter?
Yes, sir, Rob, without a shadow of a doubt, because I know in recent months that there has been district offices within FSIS that have hired people. And there is one, and I will not name the name, had hired 10 inspectors to come in. And they all came in, and within a week, 5 of them left. Now, that is going to have great impact to an inspector that maybe only had to inspect 4 plants, processing facilities. Now they're going to be double the work. So the workload measurement is now going to increase. So there is going to be less oversight into what that plant is doing on a daily basis.
People might argue, industry, I think, has argued over the years that, hey, if I own a processing facility, I don't want to make people sick. If nothing else, it's bad for business, right? I have an incentive to police myself. Even if inspectors are stretched thin, even if they're not as willing to report, isn't there that built-in incentive that's protecting people?
Well, there is. And just as in life, you've got the good plants that are going to be that conscious of it. And then you are going to have the plants that it's all about getting the product out to make the money. It's all about corporate America and making the money. And if the plant is in oversight mode, they're regulating themselves. What bank in this country regulates themselves without a body that's overseeing them?
When it comes to the safety of the food we see at the store, what are your concerns if these changes take effect, these union protections and staffing gets even tighter? What are your concerns for the public as they shop for food?
I, as a public servant until September 30th of this year, you know, I am always concerned about John Q. Public going out there and ensuring that the product that they eat is properly labeled and wholesome for their families. You know, we've had the Boar's Head outbreak. I do not want to see that again. It should not take deaths for us to react to something like that.
We're in Wisconsin, of course. We've got a lot of agriculture here. If people lose trust in the food system because some of these changes, do you think this could have an impact on our farm economy if people aren't trusting the products that are being made and processed here in the state?
I totally agree. You know, I find myself, and I see it more and more prevalent throughout even Wisconsin, throughout the country, as a matter of fact, the little mom and pop lockers that raise their own animals, or they have farms that raise the animals, so they know exactly where those animals are coming in. My family, I mean, my stepson, that's where we buy our beef from. I think you're going to see more and more of that happening, that the mom and pop lockers, that's how I grew up knowing them, will be more prevalent.
One of the arguments, I think, has from the federal government and from this administration has been, well, this is going to go to the states and local governments to handle these kind of food safety inspection issues. Do you see the infrastructure there for, say, the state of Wisconsin to pick up the slack?
Well, and that would be interesting. It would depend on what the budget would be then that the state of Wisconsin would give that agriculture department. I know in recent years that there's been cooperative agreements made with the states. And I do believe that it was Wyoming was a state that they did their own inspection. Well, they didn't have the funding to do that inspection. So then all those plants had to go federal. So it really comes down to the money part of it then, Rob.
Paula, are you hopeful at all that some of these changes could be reversed or fixed in a way that would make you feel like, yes, our food safety is being protected?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of a team collaboration between inspection. You know, when I came in and as an inspector in May of 1987, we regulated what the industry does. Now, industry regulates what the inspectors do. And, you know, everybody has their right to due process and their appeal rights. Sometimes, though, and I have heard in recent weeks and days, where there has been situations that inspectors have raised the concern about food safety in given plants that have come on a deaf ear.
Paula, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Take care. Be safe.
That was Paula Soldner, food safety inspector in southern Wisconsin for more than 30 years, now chair of the National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals. We've been talking about how food safety workers are being affected by new federal policies and funding cuts. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, recently scaled back a federal-state surveillance program for foodborne diseases. This is happening as confidence in U.S. food safety has hit an all-time low. That's according to an annual survey commissioned by the International Food Information Council. Craig Hedberg is professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Minnesota and co-director of the Minnesota Integrated Food Safety Center of Excellence. Craig, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Before we dig into recent changes in our food safety system, I'm hoping you can spell out the big picture of how our food safety system works. We've got different agencies, the USDA, FDA, and the CDC, for example, involved. How is our food protected?
Well, our food system is very complex, and how food is regulated is also very complex. In the United States, we have two major federal agencies that are involved in regulating our food supply. We have the U.S. Department of Agriculture has a food safety inspection service that is responsible for meat and poultry products, along with some egg products. And the Food and Drug Administration basically is responsible for the bulk of the rest of the food that moves through interstate commerce. In the United States has a federal system. And so there is also regulatory activity that happens at the state and local level. So those are the agencies that are really set up to monitor food production, to make sure that companies are performing all of the steps that they need to take to produce safe food. The part that I really work with the most is our public health system. Our foodborne disease surveillance and tracking systems that really provide the ultimate measure of how effective the food companies and the regulators are at ensuring the safety of the food. Because if there's a problem with the food that gets distributed, then that can lead to foodborne illness. And so we have a tracking system for foodborne illnesses that is based on individual state laws and then the public health system that exists in individual states. And this varies from state to state. So Wisconsin has a different system for tracking and reporting diseases than, say, we have here in Minnesota. And CDC, the National Center for Disease Control, plays a coordinating role across states so that when we have a multi-state outbreak, CDC will help coordinate the investigations that are going on within individual states so that we can rapidly identify what the source of that outbreak might have been. And those investigations are really critical because when we can identify the source of a problem and identify what led to the occurrence of that outbreak, then that gives us tools we can work with industry to try to change conditions and help improve the safety of the food going forward.
There have been a lot of shakeups, no secret, in the federal government in the new the second Trump administration. We just heard from a USDA inspector worried about the loss of union protections, a lot of people leaving the job. Have you seen anything in the last, 6-8 months that has you particularly concerned about foodborne illness?
Yeah, I think, the turmoil that has been going on in the federal agencies is certainly felt throughout our food safety system. The real problem with sort of cutting funds for FoodNet is that it in a way normalizes the idea that foodborne disease surveillance is both expensive and non-essential, when in fact we have really good evidence that the amount of money that we put into foodborne disease surveillance in the long run saves money because we can better identify the causes of foodborne illness, and that leads to better prevention measures, which then helps to reduce the burden of foodborne illness. And so to the extent that we begin to see these individual cuts in programs, none of which may totally disable the program, but cumulatively, the effect is to reduce the capacity of our public health system to respond effectively when an outbreak happens, and then to translate that knowledge into better prevention measures down the road.
We've seen some survey results from the International Food Information Council. They do an annual food and health survey. They found the latest results, confidence in U.S. food safety is the lowest we've seen. Is the public right to be concerned about our food safety? Is this a messaging thing? What do you see when it comes to our trust, the public's trust in how safe our food is?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a complicated story. One of the things that has been driving sort of concern about the safety of our food is both the occurrence of outbreaks and the occurrence of recalls of food products. And both of those things, you know, on the face of it, seem to be measures of problems within the food system. But, you know, as I said at the beginning, we have a very complex food system, and there always are going to be new things, new challenges arising in the production of food. And one measure of that is the outbreaks that occur. But our ability to detect those outbreaks and identify those sources of contamination is actually a positive thing. So in some measures, a recall of a food item isn't always an indication that the problems are getting worse. It's an indication that we're doing a better job of tracking down the problems before illnesses actually occur.
Craig, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Craig Hedberg, co-director of the Minnesota Integrated Food Safety Center of Excellence and professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Minnesota. Earlier, we heard from Paula Soldner of Beloit, chair of the National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals. We've been talking about food safety in the United States.
Coming up, meet a Wisconsin volunteer who went viral online for his work at a special needs cat shelter in Green Bay.
And we do have some semi-feral cats here, and I particularly like to work with them to get them calmed down. And I've had any number of them that have been adopted as very sweet cats.
That's next here on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about navigating parenthood.
Andrew Patry is like most parents. The Eau Claire author loves his child. He strives to support her, help her succeed, and help her stay safe. But accomplishing these goals can be awkward. Parenthood often means entering uncharted territory. Patry explores this in his book, Clumsy Love. He reads us an excerpt from that memoir.
Follow your path. Quite a view today, I say to the top of my daughter Simone's head, her face pushed into the crumple of sweatshirt on the picnic table. Her response is lost in a muffle of cotton. We are at the University of Wisconsin. The terrace is bustling with students and other people out enjoying the afternoon, the sky nearly cloudless and blue. We are lucky to have found a table so near the water of Lake Mendota. A rowing group glides by, a man with a megaphone perched like a gull at the stern. Closer, two bulldogs lay between the legs of their owners. The woman checks to see that the green leash is securely fastened to the back of her chair and looks our way, her eyes seeming to linger on Simone. My wife, Adrienne, motions with her head. Maybe we should go. I set down my cider and look to our daughter, still bowed over the table. The afternoon sun warms the nape of her neck between her parted hair. Sure, I nod. We walk parallel to the water, Adrienne and I several paces ahead, while Simone lags behind. Nearby, ducks swim. I look back and catch Simone with arms raised, nose sniffing her armpits. I avert my eyes and look ahead instead, to spare us both embarrassment. She's nervous about tomorrow, I say. Totally nervous, Adrienne agrees. Me too. This is new for all of us. 2 years ago, our child informed us that she was our daughter, not our son. It has been a year since her name legally changed from the masculine to its feminine counterpart. Now, May 2018, Simone is 11, one summer away from middle school, and adamant she not go through male puberty. The following morning, we pile into the car and drive from the hotel to the pediatric and transgender health clinic. We park, stretch our legs, and head toward the lobby to check in. The receptionist sends us up a small set of marble stairs to the waiting room. We pull open the glass door and take a seat. Simone approaches the large aquarium in the center of the room, bending closer to watch the fish that fan out as if to make space for her. Simone's name is called, and we follow a woman in blue scrubs to the doctor's office, find three chairs along the wall, and sit. Soon, there is a knock, and a cheerful voice behind the door says, "Hello, you must be Simone." Our daughter nods. The doctor enters. She has a cherubic face framed by close-cropped red hair and is wearing a petite white lab coat. No doubt, a reassuring presence to scores of children. However, when she asks Simone the purpose of this visit, Simone is diffident, leaning toward Adrian's ear and whispering for her to explain. Adrian says, "We wanted to go over puberty blockers. Simone is going to be 12 in a few months, and she's really worried the process has already begun." The doctor focuses on Simone. "Well, the good news is, puberty doesn't happen all at once." "I don't want any of it," Simone says.
Author Andrew Patry of Eau Claire brought us that story, Follow Your Path. It's an excerpt from his memoir, Clumsy Love, A Father's Journey Parenting His Transgender Daughter. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
At a cat shelter in Green Bay, a retired volunteer is living every cat lover's and nap lover's dream.
For 7 years, 82-year-old former teacher Terry Lauerman has been donating his time to Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary. It's a shelter dedicated to rescuing cats and dogs with special needs and disabilities. His specialty? Lying down and taking a snooze with the shelter's cats.
Videos and photos of Terry practicing his signature skill have gone viral online, generating support for the shelter and getting him featured on CBS Sunday Morning. He even had a mini documentary made about it. Terry joins us now, along with Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary owner Elizabeth Feldhausen. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Terry, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Now, Terry, have you had a lifelong connection with cats, or was this something that came as a new thing in your post-retirement career?
Okay, when I was a kid, I had cats always, but once I went away to college and got into professional work for years and years, I had no connection with cats. But once I retired at 65, I said I want to do something fun, and so I went back to cats that I liked and started volunteering at a local shelter here in Green Bay, not this one, but a different one. I was a volunteer at Bay Area Humane Society for a while and Door County Humane Society.
And Terry, the cats at Safe Haven, what first brought you in there to be with the cats and nap with them and hang out with them?
Okay, this shelter is a free roam shelter. The previous shelters where I worked, the cats were in cages, and so that's a completely different type of situation. So when I saw that this was free roam, I came in. So you can interact with the cats, you can pet them, and you can feed them, you can do all sorts of things. And it's more like a home-like situation. That's why I like it here.
And Terry, you're at the shelter right now, I understand. Is there a cat on or near you right now?
Yes, there's one right on my shoulder. His name is Jimmy.
Jimmy.
Jimmy is an orange kitty, very sweet. And he's with me every afternoon.
Elizabeth, introduce us, please, to the mission of Safe Haven.
Sure. So Safe Haven is a nonprofit organization that was started so that animals with special needs and disabilities, or animals who may have, you know, different emotional needs coming from neglect or abuse, have somewhere where they can go that is peaceful and psychologically beneficial for them to recover in a home-like environment so that they could avoid being euthanized in other overcrowded shelters.
And tell us a little more about what kind of cats would end up or do end up at Safe Haven.
Yeah, so it's really been a variety over the last 10 years. So it can be anywhere from maybe they're just missing an eye, maybe they're deaf in one ear, to full paralysis where we are helping them go to the bathroom, but, you know, they're all still enjoying their life here. And we make the modifications we have to make sure that they get what they need.
And you work, I imagine, Elizabeth, with various volunteers. Terry starts showing up. What made Terry stand out as a volunteer?
Honestly, he didn't talk very much, and we introduced ourselves, and we barely knew each other, and then he just started falling asleep all over the place, and that's honestly what made him stand out.
You know, when you get old, you fall asleep easily, so that's natural.
But that's, I think, part of what cats might like about you, Terry. I know cats don't always like it when people are, like, trying hard and intruding on their space. What is your secret to getting the cats to come to you and appreciate your presence?
Okay. Treats are very helpful. Some cats are extremely treat motivated, so they follow me around like the Pied Piper sort of thing, and they're looking for their treats all the time. And there's one... that we have over here.
Lila.
She follows me around every day. I come to the door and she comes running on her two front paws because her back legs don't work. And she's always looking for treats from me. And so I enjoy working with the special needs cats. This is a special needs cat too, the Jimmy here. He's diabetic. And so that's his issue.
Mm-hmm.
And Terry, do you see the cats having like really different personalities where you have to approach, you know, this cat in one way, this cat in another way?
Absolutely. You've got to see what they're willing to allow you to do. Some of them will allow you to touch them right away. Otherwise, it takes weeks sometimes for them to allow you to touch them. And we do have some semi-feral cats here. And I particularly like to work with them to get them calmed down. And I've had any number of them that have been adopted as very sweet cats after several months of working with them. So
we're talking to Terry Lauerman. He volunteers at Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary in Green Bay, known as the Cat Napper online, not as someone who takes cats, but takes naps in the vicinity of cats. And we've got Elizabeth Feldhausen, founder and CEO of Safe Haven, with us. Elizabeth, so you've got Terry there. He's falling asleep with the cats. The cats love him. You start sharing pictures online. What happened?
Yeah, that was crazy. So I was, you know, just doing my normal job. All of a sudden, Terry's falling asleep on the couch again. A cat named Lewis piled on top of him, who was a really sweet cat we had here, but got adopted. And it was just a really cute picture. And so I didn't really think too much of it. I just snapped the picture and put up something cute on social media. Suddenly, mm-hmm. a day later, Terry went viral.
Terry, what was that like for you? You're there, you're volunteering with cats, you're taking naps, and you become an internet celebrity of sorts.
Yeah. Well, it was crazy. And all of a sudden, I'd start getting emails from England and Spain and Portugal and Australia. And people were looking at these pictures online. And I thought, oh my gosh, all I'm doing is sleeping with a cat. And I'm all over the world with different people. So it was quite shocking, really.
Elizabeth, did that that celebrity that Terry got, did it end up benefiting the sanctuary?
Oh, yes, 100%. I can't remember the exact number, but I do know that we raised over $60,000. I believe it might have been $68,000 was the actual number. But that was all within about a week.
Wow.
All of a sudden, donations are pouring in, mm-hmm. Because people, you know, see that we're cage free and that the cats here do get the opportunity to just fall asleep on a visitor. And I think that really, you know, said something to people, and they just loved it. Mm-hmm. It was in a time when people were really needing a boost of happiness. Mm-hmm. So it just worked out that way as well.
Elizabeth, for people, especially in your local community, what are some of the best ways they can do to help a sanctuary like Safe Haven?
They can, obviously, you know, cats need litter and food, so donating litter, food, supplies to us is always very helpful. They can certainly volunteer with us. We are always looking for volunteers, whether it be for scooping the boxes in the shelter or events. And they can also honestly just share our posts, spread the word, talk about what we do here, and get others to stop in. And, you know, even if you don't have $5 to donate and you talk about us, you probably have a friend that has that $5 to donate. And word of mouth is honestly great in the city of Green Bay.
Terry, going beyond the cats, I understand this isn't the only volunteer work you do. Can you offer words of encouragement for especially that new retiree to find some purpose in life, maybe by volunteering?
Yeah, well, once you end a career, and it's been great. I love my teaching career. And look around and see if there's something that you might be interested in. You know, there's all sorts of ecology things that you can do. You can help with various municipal programs that are looking for volunteers at libraries and different sorts of things. So whatever seems to interest you, go after it and fill your free time with something fun and helpful for other people.
I got to ask, Terry, obviously you enjoy being around cats. That's part of the story here. But being around the same cats for longer periods of time, do you feel like you have a better understanding now of the mind of the cat?
I've learned a lot about cats working with them. But I'll tell you, what really is interesting is I will say work for while with a cat, and all of a sudden it's adopted, and that is very difficult to let a cat go once you have invested emotionally in a cat, and it happens all the time. But no matter how many are adopted, there are always more that need attention, so I'm never in a deficit for attention with other cats. That it's satisfying to be there. And I always make the decision, I will never visit a cat that's been adopted. I would be very tempted to do it, but if I were visiting the cats that have been adopted that I liked, I wouldn't have any time to do anything else. So.
We'll leave it there. Terry, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Elizabeth Feldhausen is owner and CEO of Safe Haven Pet Sanctuary in Green Bay. And Terry Lauerman is a retired volunteer with Safe Haven. He's gone viral for being the shelter's professional cat napper, known for taking snoozes with the shelter's residents. We heard why Terry is involved in volunteering after retirement. And we want to hear from you. Do you volunteer in your community? What do you do, even if it isn't, you know, taking naps with cats? If you're retired, what does volunteering mean for your post-retirement life? If you're not retired, what motivates you to get involved? Email wisconsintoday at WPR.org. That's wisconsintoday at WPR.org. Coming up Monday on the show, we'll hear about the joy of visiting small towns in Wisconsin, and we'll get some great recommendations on places to go.
And we want to hear from you. What's your favorite small community to visit in the state? What do you like about it? Where do you go on the weekends for these mini little road trips?
Or if you want to put in a plug for your own hometown as a great place to visit, go ahead, make your case.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. Our message line, the number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that number is 888-642-0232 for visiting small towns in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Rochelle Wilson, and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Tim Peterson is managing producer, and Dean Kennetter is our executive producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.